Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the record fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia, and the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Slick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Our podcast is sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for one of the largest selections in America of football cards and memorabilia at MSBSportsCards.com. And we're also sponsored by BST Auctions. Check out their website for future information on their upcoming football, memorabilia, and card auction at BSTAuctions.com. And now it's time. I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football history member, historian, who specializes in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Lord. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires, Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Good to be here, Captain. Thank you for the always eloquent introduction. It's always interesting that Steve Largent and Red Grange said in the same breath during my intro. That one's always raised my eyebrow.
Well, they were two very iconic players of different time frames, to say the least. And you are, in my opinion, and I've always said this, an expert on Red Grange and also an expert on Steve Largent. And it's a very interesting collection that you have of those two players.
I appreciate that, Captain. Thank you. I can think of about three people off the top of my head who probably know more or as much about Red Grange as I do. So I appreciate the tag.
Well, you know, talking over the years, and you know, you bringing up a lot of stuff about Grange and a lot of his memorabilia. To me, you are a historian of Grange and a collector of Grange. Top two category. Largent, you cannot be touched. I don't care what anybody says. And I go back to what I say all the time. I have people here locally who will see me at a show or say, hey Bob, can you just lead me to a Steve Largent rookie card from the 77 top set because I can't find it anywhere. And I always tell them, you know, they're basically tied up in Portland, Oregon from the largest Steve Largent collector in America.
I forget we had a guest once who couldn't find, who actually just talked about that, and I mailed him one after the show.
Yep.
If
any local show that I see a Largent rookie, I just basically buy him because I know down the road somebody's going to ask me for one here in New England.
Yeah.
So, but shifting gears a little, Joe, we have a troubling hobby issue that's coming to light again, and something we talked about in a couple of previous shows over the past 4 years. And that's the issue of the 1948 Leaf football set. And it's an issue with recoloring. It's an issue of retrimming. It's an issue of cards being slabbed that are trimmed with, to me, very misguided grades on them. Can you give us a little history and background and fill in our audience on this problem again?
Yeah, and I wrote an article about this, and Gridiron Grade Number 51. I think that was about a year ago, wasn't it? I forget.
Right.
It's kind of resurfaced again. A couple of people have emailed me asking about it, and then there's a friend of ours, a fellow collector, who has voiced recently that he's been tracking the issue as well, which kind of brought it back to light. And basically, it's not just the 4-8 leaf set, but the leaf set is the one that I track the most. It's the set that I'm most passionate about, during my collecting years. But it's the Chicle, it's the leaf, mm-hmm. I think it's easier in modern cards. I don't collect as many modern cards, but I've actually been at the National, hung out with, with dealers and watched them trim cards and, mm-hmm. And how they trim them. And you're talking modern cards, you're talking a 64th of an inch. I mean, when you trim it, the little piece of cardboard, curls up, and falls in the ground because it's so thin. And they put in a top loader, and they literally took a socket wrench to the edge to make it look like it'd been factory. But that's modern stuff. I mean, so when people are saying, well, I don't know, does trimming exist? I've seen it with my own two eyes, trimming. So yes, it exists. But what we wanted to talk about today was the leaf set. Because I think the leaf set is one of the most prolifically doctored sets out there. Just because of the variations that are inherent within the set. Like I wrote in the article, and just a little bit of background, the 4-8 leaf set is one of the sets that I fell in love with when I started getting back into collecting, back mm-hmm. in, mm-hmm. 2001, 2002. I remember seeing the George Savitsky card as one of the first ones I saw, and I was like, wow, that is an amazing looking set. The history in it, I think there's a dozen Hall of Fame rookie cards in the set, from
right.
Bobby Lane to Bednarik, Sammy Baugh. I mean, it's just, love the set. I probably, as you and I were talking about before the show came on, I probably own 1,000 Leaf cards, and 900 of them are raw. I probably mm-hmm. have between five and six variations or copies of each card in the set. You start getting into the second series, and I don't have as many, but I've got 5 or 6 Bobby Lane cards down there. And my wife used to laugh at me because I'd buy these raw cards, and I would measure them. I have some digital calipers. I'd just measure them, and then I'd mm-hmm. track what the dimensions are. I'd put the card in a penny sleeve, and then put it in a top loader, and then jot the dimensions on the back in a Sharpie, so that I could track each mm-hmm. one. So I have a spreadsheet somewhere on my laptop that's just got, Bobby Leaf, card number 3, and then on the back in Sharpie's written. I know the dimensions. And what mm-hmm. I came to determine is the average dimension of the leaf set is 60 millimeters by 70 millimeters. There's a long end and a top end, and a shallow end. Some of the cards are horizontal, most of them are vertical. Obviously, on the vertical ones, they're 70 millimeters tall and 60 wide. And I just began, if you buy a card slabbed, you can also measure them within the slab. A little more difficult, but you can do that with some patience. And I began to notice what the smallest card, that PSA will slab is about 56 by 65. So 60
so
by
that's
70
about
feet.
Okay, so how far is the deviation then? So we're looking at a 0.5 and a 0.10 or from the 60?
Yeah, so 60 by 70 is your average. I've seen them as small as 56 by 65, so that's minus 3 to 4 millimeters on the small end and minus 5 millimeters on the large end. And I've seen them as large as 64 by 75. So, I mean, as I wrote in the article, this leaf set is fraught with printing errors. You've got, black name on front, white name on front, white between the legs, mm-hmm. Johnny misspelled, Johnny good, gorgeous George or no gorgeous. I mean, anybody who collects a set knows that it's just fraught with printing errors. It's not a stretch of the imagination to realize that, if it's printed so shoddily, it was probably cut shoddily. It's just a PSA accepted standard that there are variations on it. And there's, you know, in modern sets, there's no variation. They're guided and they're laser cut. On this one,
right.
You can tell they just, the attention to detail wasn't there. So you've got it as small as, let's say, 56 millimeters and as large as 64 millimeters on the short side, and as small as 65 and as large as 75 on the long side. If you take the delta between that 65 and 75 on the long side, that's 10 millimeters, or about 3/8 of an inch. 3/8 of an inch on a card is a lot of wiggle room. Those are grading standards. If you found a card that was, you know, 62 by 72, you know, I mean, that's, you trim one to 3 millimeters off of it, you're still well within PSA's grading standard, and you can slip it by a grader and get it slabbed. So if you find that Chuck Bednarik card that's a little bit fat bordered, and you know what you're doing, you can get it into a card or into a holder and sell it. And that's the problem with the industry right now. I love this set, and I've been tracking it for years, but, you know, 3-4 years ago, as I started seeing these very, very thin cards getting graded and getting sold, it bothered me. And I began to love my set.
It's just another, to me, reason why I truly dislike graded cards, and anybody who knows me knows my arguments on it. But in this case, you know, here's a prime example. You're basically being fraudulently sold a card that's been doctored and stated as something that it isn't. So if you take it out and try to sell it raw, and somebody actually, you know, goes through it and say, hey, you know, this looks like it was trimmed, this looks like it was recolored, yada yada yada, why am I buying this card? This card is worthless to me. And every time we talk about this, I pull my 48 leaf binder out, and I got a lot of cards that are beaters. I got a lot of cards that have rating on them, and so I know they're pretty much real cards. I do some measuring of them at the same time, and I see some of them are off, and I can see how they're legitimately off. Some are basically just worn down type of thing. But I'm saying to myself, I feel I got a legitimate 48 leaf set. And again, I collected that set back in the 80s. And the last few cards that I needed, I basically traded with a good friend of mine in the 90s. So I'm pretty much confident they're not doctored. But I'm saying to myself, why would anybody want to collect that set today, you know, today? Especially with all this going on. And I think a lot of it is just fueled by this hysteria of a graded card in a particular condition, and that makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
It really does. You know,
we've said it 100 times. The registry is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, and again, you know, you see I see overpressure on rookie cards being graded now. PSA 9s, PSA 10s, and I guess I'm supposed to jump up and down if I had a PSA 10 and I spent, let's say, $150,000 on the card when the card really only, you know. If it's a near mint card or mint card in a Beckett book, it should go for $4,000 or $5,000. What justifies that kind of price increase? You know, it doesn't make sense. It's irrational, and it's going to hurt the hobby in the long run. And I think,
I think
it's hurting the hobby right now more than anything else. You know.
Well, and to think that people are aware that trimming goes on is a misnomer, because about 5 years ago, there was a heavy hitter who came into the leaf set and started buying up a lot of high-end leafs. And there was a PSA 8.5 George Connor that was listed on eBay for like $10,000. And it was just sitting there wallowing for a year. Nobody who knew anything about the industry was buying it, because everybody in the know knew it was trimmed. Well, this new guy comes along, gets to buy it now on it, and, you know, I saw the card disappear. And at one point, about a week later, I'm talking to him. I'm like, yeah, I'm talking about trimmed cards. And I go, yeah, I'll take that George Connor that was just on eBay. I mean, it was trimmed. And he's like, I bought that. I'm like, what do you mean? How do you know it's trimmed? And I'm like, look at it. Compare it to some of your other cards that are good. I mean, just look at it. And he's like, well, but it's slabbed. I mean, his excuse was, it's slabbed. It's been authenticated by, you know, a third-party grader in PSA in this instance. I mean, it's been authenticated. They guarantee it's not trimmed. And I'm like, oh, my. So, I mean, there are people out there who take the fact that it's in a slab as the gospel, and it's a good card, and it's actually not. I'm sure you've done it too, but never get cheated, you know, Joe Orlando's, you know, catchy little tagline. is an ironic joke amongst, you know, most collectors. It's sad. You know, here's this gentleman who bought a trimmed car. I'm like, that's useless. And then, you know, about a year later, he started selling cars off, for other reasons. But, yeah, that's kind of tough because I had a really nice PSA 8 George Connor that was full-sized. You know, who knows? Maybe it was a really large – yeah, I mean, it was full-sized. And when a trimmed card comes up on eBay and the educated people don't bid on it, you know, and a card that usually goes for $3,000 goes for $1,500 because most of the heavy hitters who are knowledgeable about the set skip it. It dilutes the value of the higher end cards. You know, and you've also got the card doctors out there who are buying really good looking, you know, PSA 4, 5, and 6 cards, and they're going to crack them out and take them. I mean, you can tell when a card is full bordered. You can look at it. If it's got a dinged corner, or some paper loss in the very tip corner, and you can trim 2-3 millimeters off that to get rid of that corner. There are people who are buying those really nice PSA 5 cards. That's the sweet spot. You know, you spend $50 or $60 on a PSA 5 card, and you have time on your hands.
That relates to. It kind of relates to me. Probably a couple months back, I went to a local show, and a fella had some PSA-graded exhibit cards, and he's trying to tell me how rare they are, blah, blah, blah. Well, there were like 3s and 4s, and I said to him, you know, I only collect raw cards. So he says, well, just buy it and crack it out. And I said, well, why would I buy something that's older when I have no intention of keeping the holder, and I got to pay 3 times as much of what it costs raw, only to throw throw it out? So then he's trying to argue with me. Well, you know, it's authentic. I said, well, not really, because I actually told him about the 48 Leafs. He had no clue what to come back with. You know what I mean? And he basically ignored me after I said that. And I'm saying to myself, and I don't go around to a show and try to tell people. I just act like a normal customer walking around there. I'm not trying to, you know, blow my horn or anything like that. But still,
the moment you open your voice, people are like, "Are you Bob Swick from Gridiron Greats Podcast?" How many times during a show does that happen?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a question to me. You know, you want to be a dealer, you're going to set up, and I do give the local dealers a lot of. Leeway, because I know a lot of these guys are weekend warriors, or a lot of these guys in heritage collections, they just want to unload them, that type of situation, and they read, you know, oh, I got something graded, so therefore it's the best thing ever, not realizing that in a lot of cases it's garbage more than anything else, you know what I mean? So it's a tough situation, and again, I feel bad for the 48 Leaf set, because again, you only have the 48 and 49 Leaf set. And again, you know, to really date myself, the first 49 Leafs I picked up were in the 70s. And I'm saying to myself, wow, this is a big set. It was like from 1 to card 154 or whatever it was. And I've been, you know, as the years went on and I finally got my first price guide back in the 80s, I'm saying, wow, that's a skip numbered set. I always wondered why I never saw any of those other cards collecting over the years, you know, type of thing. And, you know, it's stuff like that. That the innocence of the hobby to me is long gone. When you got a situation now today, now fast forward 40 years later, where the biggest concern is to buy a raw card and get it into, you know, encased in a slab holder for as long as possible, you know, as fast as possible, in order to drive up the price of that card 10 times over. And for what? You know? It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
And I'll admit, I'm a recovering, registry, addict. I mean, I still have slabbed cards, but most of my cards are slabbed now are because I want to physically protect them. You know, tickets, postcards, et cetera. So, but lots of, in the article I touched on, 10 things that, trimming is the biggest thing. You know, it's what most people look for. Smelling a card. You're feeling it, touching it up to your lips. I mean, smelling. I mean, cards should smell like a 70-year-old card. I mean, feeling it for wetness to see if it's been soaked recently. Looking at it under your loop, looking for striations. And, an ex-grader, you know, probably about 8-9 years ago, told me about striations. I remember at the Baltimore National, he's like, blah, 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 look for striations. Like, what is a striation? He's like, oh,
yeah.
come
yeah.
here, Joe. You know, and he
yeah.
showed it to me
yeah.
under a loop.
Yeah.
You know, but there are
exactly.
people out there who are ahead of the game who are good at recreating these striations on emery boards. You know, you get
mm-hmm.
you get recoloring, you get, you know, and then I've just recently learned about power erasing, you know, which is a fascinating thing. Laser
mm-hmm.
printers, people making their own slabs, people laser printing off PSA flips. You know, and then prying open a card, and then you know, slipping in a new flip on a nice looking card, and then sealing it. I mean, this
yep.
this hobby is fraught with people digging, you know, digging pitfalls for the poor, you know, the poor
yep.
naive hobbyist.
When money gets involved in a hobby. This is an example of what happens. All right, Joe, thanks for giving us the information on the 48 Leaf. We're going to, I believe our guest is here tonight, and our guest is an advanced football autograph, an autograph photo collector, who was featured in our issue number 48 issue as our super collector. He hails from Overland Park, Kansas. I'd like to introduce to our listening audience this evening, Mr. Jeff Grubb. Jeff, welcome to the show this evening.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We talked briefly in Chicago a couple years back. I wish I had brought a couple thousand copies of issue 48 because I know I would have sold them that day. I know you had a lot of your friends there, and they kept coming back to the table to buy up whatever I had.
Yeah, well,
and,
the few I had, they were all there.
I almost called my wife and I said, "Ship every 48 you got to me overnight.
Get in the hotel,
so I
can
have it."
Well, I appreciate that.
Jeff, our first question tonight: what started you collecting football autographs and autographed football photos?
Well, it was kind of a natural evolution for me. I started collecting baseball through the mail, kind of haphazardly in the mid-60s. I grew up just south of St. Louis, and, you know, it'll probably come out in the conversation at least once or twice today. I'm a rare duck. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals football fan, but you know how voracious St. Louis Cardinal baseball fans are. So as a youngster, I would write back and forth to the baseball players, you know, when I was 6, 7, 8 years old, and didn't really ever give it much thought as far as football. And then when I got out of college and my work life moved me to Atlanta, Georgia, I hooked up with a couple fellow hobbyists who are now lifelong friends at this point. We go to the National together. And one of them was really, really, really into these wire photos that the newspapers had started selling off. And he was doing a lot of baseball, but he had been able to pick up several copies of football photos in large lots and things like that. And he offered to sell those to me, and I was kind of getting into what he was doing on the baseball side. And then, you know, later that year or maybe the next year, I picked up a large lot at the National for under $1 a photo. And by that point, I had joined a couple of websites which dealt primarily with the through-to-mail auto hobby, so I had a good idea who signed from my days of sending baseball and football cards off. So it was just kind of a natural progression because, you know, you only need so many signed 1969 Don Brum cards. At some point, you need some other medium to start getting autographs. So
that's for sure.
Wow. So, Jeff, I'm not a big autograph collector. I mean, I collect, as Bob mentioned earlier in the show, I'm a big Steve Largent fan, and I have lots of autographs of his, including,
yeah.
you know, pictures that I've had taken with him over the years.
Right.
But recently, I was at a Super Bowl party down in Palm Springs, and the host of the party knew Johnny Lujack and Terry Baker, two Heisman Trophy Award winners. And I got their autograph, and I got a picture with both of them, two living, you know, Heisman winners, which is pretty fascinating.
Right.
And suddenly I'm starting to love these autographs. It kind of, I suppose that's how most people become collectors, but I'm curious, what are the top five things in your collection? And I guess they don't necessarily have to be autographs. I mean, do you buy anything other than autographs?
I would tell you that probably, if somebody told me that I had to, my wife said, hey, you got to drill all this down. You get five items, all the rest of the stuff would have to go. Probably at this point, not one of those items would be an autographed item. I've got a couple. I would tell you I've got a couple early to mid 60s St. Louis Cardinal football Dureen sideline jackets. One of them was worn by Mel Hammock, and the other one I haven't been able to pinpoint exactly whose it is. The number wasn't stitched inside. It was written with a marker, and it's bled so much I can't tell. I can tell that it's real, but, and then I've got a 1984 game ball that was painted up and awarded to Roy Green for a game against the Bears. I think he had six catches, about 170 yards, maybe a couple touchdowns, things like that. When I was in graduate school, that was in the mid-80s, I attended the University of Memphis, and that was right in the sweet spot of the Showboats. I was there from 83 to 85, which, was right along the same time. So I've got a couple items, game used items from the Showboat, USFL Showboats, one being a helmet, the other being a white road jersey. That would probably be one. And then when I was growing up, I bought most of my sporting goods at Western Auto, and in 1966, I believe it was, Rawlings did a poster for their sporting goods with pretty large black and white poster featured. I'm sure it was a regional job. I can't imagine these guys having any kind of nationwide popularity as far as advertising goes, but it featured Sonny Randall, Bobby Joe Conrad, and Jim Bakken on a big Rawlings poster. And, I'd go in, I'd stop in there two or three times on the way walking from school, and I knew the guy that owned the store, and I'd look at the poster, and I can remember asking, you could see if you could get me another one, and he probably never did ask the salesman, but he did tell me that when football season was over and it was time to put up the baseball, that he'd give it to me. And
that's cool.
He did give it to me. It was on my wall for probably from about 1966 until I left home to go to college in 77. That one has since disappeared, but in the last 12 months, I was able to find another one on eBay that was just exactly like one, same thing, much better shape. So that's probably one of my top five items as well, I would say. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. Sports Illustrated probably used to have these posters. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jeff. I was just saying Sports Illustrated used to have these posters. Like in like 81, 82. And I had the Chargers ones at the time. I was a big Chargers fan at the time, Dan Fouts and Kellen Winslow.
Right.
About 2 months ago, I came across, I was in somebody's house, and I saw that their kids had these posters. And I took a picture, and I texted it to Todd Tobias, who's a big Chargers fan. I'm like, look at this. I haven't seen one of these in 30 years, but it really took me back, in time. It was kind of cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I would tell you, I love all the signed stuff I have, and I'm kind of like a little kid. Every once in a while, I'll pull two or three binders out on a Saturday night when I'm sitting on the couch watching a football game and go through them and everything like that. So it's not that I don't really enjoy that. The part of that I enjoy probably as much as having it is actually just sending it to somebody and getting it back. I mean, that's always kind of been a lot of fun for me, and. One of the things that happens with these photos that I sent out, these wire photos, is a lot of the time, I have to think that a lot of them I get signed, although they may not be unique, there may be some other signed copies of them out there. They're not like a 1970 Tops or a reproduced photo file photo or something like that. But it's really, really intriguing the amount of communication some of these players have with you. For instance, a couple of years ago, I sent two of them to Lenny Moore for him to sign. Of course, I knew Lenny signed. He's got a small charge through the mail, but he mailed them back to me unsigned, and he said, I'll be happy to sign these for you, but I'd like you to make me a couple of copies of each of them. I've never seen them before. Could you make me copies of them before I sign them and send them back to me, and I'll send them back? So, and then there's been several other times where, you know, it may be somebody, you know, one of the guys that I could think of, trying to think of who done it, who basically turned the photo over and written, you know, two or three paragraphs on the back. I can remember this exact play. I can remember this game, you know, so on, so forth. So it's not uncommon. You know, it's not just like going to a show and standing in line and being an autograph mill or something like that. It's not uncommon for them to either include a note and say, hey, would you send me a copy of this? Or, you know, this was probably the best game of my life or something like that. So that makes it a lot of fun. So.
That's very cool.
Jeff, I'm curious, how do you recognize if an autograph is real or not? And, you know, obviously, there's so many fake autographs out there. There's so many autopen autographs out there. There's so many autographs that may be signed by administrative people or whatever.
Sure.
Do you have any technique or anything like that?
Well, I would tell you that probably as somebody that is pretty well embedded in that area of the hobby, I'm probably most like everybody else. You know, the first thing that I would tell you is whether you're me or whether you're some wizard at PSA behind the curtain, you know, taking a look at something, unless you saw somebody sign it, you don't know with absolute certainty that it's real. I don't care what anybody says. So, you know, whether they're getting paid for their opinion or whether they're just pontificating on the phone, you don't know unless you've seen it. What you do know, what you do have a good idea of, is on certain items, you know, provenance has a lot to do with things. So, like, if I want a Vince Lombardi autograph, I'm going to buy a Green Bay Packers payroll check. That's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to hop on eBay and look for the cheapest 3x5 I can find. Not saying that there aren't authentic 3x5s out there, but you know, if I want something like that and I'm going to spend the money to get a real one or for what it takes to get something like that, I'm going to go that way, you know. Also, mm-hmm. a lot of my mm-hmm. items for people that I know that I want signed that don't sign through the mail, or either the item's too valuable to A, risk them keeping it, or B, getting lost, I'll go to the show and get them signed, and I'll stand there right in front of them and get it signed. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who have had, like you mentioned Johnny Lujack and Terry Baker before. I can tell you that, you know, Johnny Lujack and Terry Baker are very, very, very cordial and reliable signers through the mail. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there are several websites out there. It's a bigger hobby than you think, and there are people that the, you know, there's sites like sportcollectors.net and things like that where people log in their entries and how long it took to get back, or if they get, you know, if they get something back stamped or auto-pinned or, you know, doesn't look like something they've got at a show, you know, it's recorded and stuff like that. The other thing, too, is you got to use common sense. I mean, I'm not going to mail Tom Brady something and expect to get it back signed, and if I got it back signed, I wouldn't expect it to be real. So, you know, you kind of got to manage your expectations of what it is that you could expect to get. Most of your, and I would say, you know, most might be a little strong, but there are a group of football Hall of Famers who sign regularly through the mail for a small charge. I mentioned Lenny Moore before. Willie Davis, the Green Bay Packer great, he does the same thing. I mean, there's a small group. And you got to know who they are. Dan Fouts is a fantastic signer through the mail. So, but it's just
love that guy.
But again, you know, if you're talking about going back in time and getting, you know, really really old things, and you know, from the early days of the NFL, it's going to really have to be on some sort of key item, or there's going to have to be some sort of train of ownership that I could trace back to make me comfortable spending the money on that. So, you know, there are certain things that I would absolutely just have to go without having if I couldn't verify something like that. So,
it's interesting.
I don't know if that makes sense to you, but
It all makes sense. Yeah, I mean it's interesting that you talked about a manager, an equipment manager or something making autographs. I mean, that was pretty prolific back, in the 50s. I forget who it was, Bob. You might remember, but I think it was Lombardi. Came out that 70% of the Lombardi signatures were by the manager or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I've read Autograph Review for years. I know Jeff Morley, who's published it for, he's been around for 40 years plus, probably.
Yes.
And I'm always amazed at the information contained in the little, newsletter pamphlet that he comes out with and how dedicated the hobby is. And again, I always find it interesting. In my case, anytime I get an autograph, I'd only get it signed to Bob, so the player knows that I'm not going to resell it, number one, and number two, I'm not, basically, I have it signed like that because I want it part of my personal collection, and I want them to know I'm not getting it resigned. And years ago, I used to supply the Atlanta Falcons with their football cards back in the late 80s, early 90s, and besides getting cash, I used to get paid for the cards, and I got to know the press secretary quite well, and he used to feed me signed Falcon football cards from these guys, and I had them all signed into Bob. And they were very cool about it because they realized, I wasn't the type of guy that I was going to, now you're going to see in the next issue of Sports Collector's Digest, every signed Atlanta Falcon card from the 1989 team is available type of thing. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
And I think that's part of the hobby that I think hurts it a little, where you got, 60 guys at, a football training camp, and they're trying to overpower the 10 and 11-year-old kids that are there trying to get their autographs, you know what I mean? So that's something, too, that has to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been several years since I've collected like that because it just got, a couple of things. A, I got too busy work-wise to do that. I had kids that were growing up. But the scene just got crowded and ugly, in my estimation. And, just recently, there was something in the news about, I guess Jordan Spieth got into a spat with some resellers at a tournament either in Texas or California, I can't remember, where they were just basically running roughshod over kids. And,
yeah.
He refused to sign for him, and then they started swearing, I guess. So, yeah, there's a lot of that goes on. Interestingly enough, my one story about through the mail, and, I always try to remember that what you're really doing is, if you think about it, put yourself in somebody's place. You're really sending something to somebody. You're sending it to their home 9 out of 10 times. And you're really asking them for a favor. Picture somebody walking out to their mailbox every day and it's jammed full of mailing envelopes from people. They carry it into their house. They sit down at their kitchen table and either sign it or they don't sign it. So, so that's why I don't get upset, A, when I get something back and they've refused to sign it or something like that. I remember one story I like to tell, and I think I mentioned it in the magazine article, was, only one time have I ever had a player write me back and tell me, I think I've signed enough for you. And that was Billy Wade, the old Vanderbilt and Chicago Bears quarterback. I guess he had, over the years, over 20-some-odd years, he'd probably signed for me a dozen to 15 times. And it was a very cordial note. I mean, he was a fine Christian gentleman, very super guy. But I could tell from the way I interpreted the tone of his note that he must have thought I was selling everything. So, I got everything out he'd ever signed for me and made black and white copies of my copy machine and sent them all back to him and said, I won't ever send you anything else to sign, but I just want you to know how much I've appreciated everything you signed for me. They're still a part of my collection. And just to show you, here's a copy of everything.
Well, that's cool.
And
I love stories like that, the story I was telling, earlier about, how I met, two Heisman guys. Do you have, what were your most unique collecting stories of how you got autographs? Whether it's chasing Jerry Wright through an airport, waving a Sports Illustrated or, climbing through Steve Largent's open bedroom window, what are some autograph seeking stories?
You're
You know, I've never done anything quite like that. The, you know, I've got a couple what I consider pretty cool hobby stories about just kind of more random than anything else. I lived in Atlanta. You mentioned the Atlanta Falcons. I lived in Atlanta for about 18 years before I moved to Kansas.
And sorry to hear that.
Part of my, part of my sales territory was Athens, Georgia, which is a great football town, by the way. And I used to spend quite a bit of time in Athens. And I was one day I was in Athens, and I'd run behind. I hadn't been able to make it to the post office, but I had a stack of probably 15 or 20 things I was getting ready to send out to somebody for people to autograph. So I run in the post office up there, and who did I run into but Charlie Trippi. So
wow.
Charlie lives in, obviously he played at Georgia, and he still lives in Athens, and
I
got
did
a chance
you
to, well,
actually.
Yeah, if you spend much time paying any attention to Georgia football or sports, Georgia sports, you would recognize him because he's still involved quite a bit down there. And then the second story I like to tell is not so much random that I got the autograph, but y'all remember Tommy Mason, right? The Vikings and Rams
mm-hmm.
running back.
Yeah.
So I was working on trying to get as many 62 posts signed as I could, and I had sent some cards off to Tommy. It was the first time I've ever sent to him, and I was told by a couple people that very, very reliable signer. So, you know, and, you know, every autograph request I've ever sent is absolutely a handwritten letter. It's a hand-addressed envelope. It's no form letter, no stamp, return address, anything. Everything's 100%. But I never put my phone number on anything. So I come home from work one day, and on my non-work cell phone, there's a voicemail. So I start to listen to it. Jeff, this is Tommy Mason. I need you to give me a call back. I've got your card sitting here. I'd like to know whether you want them personalized or do you want me to put my number on them or not. Here's my phone number.
Oh,
so
my.
I'm thinking somebody's yanking my chain, right? But it's a Louisiana phone number. So I call him back, and it's I think if I remember correctly, Tommy's passed away now. This has been several years since this happened. But I think it was a transmission shop that he owned. So I call the number back, and a young lady answered the phone. I said, this may sound strange, but I got a phone call from this number from somebody saying that they were Tommy Mason and they wanted to call me back. I said, oh, yeah, Mr. Mason's here. Just a second. So
wow.
I just talked to him for about a half an hour. True story. So
that's actually cool.
Just, you know, odd little stuff like that will happen occasionally.
Stories like that really keep the hobby real for a lot of people. And I think we all, any advanced collector probably has a story like that somewhere down the road. And to me, I mean, you couldn't ask for a more perfect setting, you know, to have the player call you back and say, you know, what do you want me to do with these type of thing? And give me a call back. And wow, that's amazing. That's truly amazing.
Exactly. That was kind of a one of a kind occurrence there. You know, like I say, those were cards, but these photos have led to a lot of kind of personal correspondence between myself and a player, but I've never had anybody look my phone number up on the internet and give me a call other than Tommy. I'm still not quite sure how he did that, but he found me.
Amazing. Jeff, I got another question for you. Do you have any suggestions for being a collector who wants to begin a collection like this?
Yeah, a couple of things that I would say is that, you know, first of all, that there's still a lot of people who are willing signers. You know, the thing I would tell people is to be courteous, you know, do your research. You know, don't waste your time or your money. There are lots of resources out there where you can find that you can correspond with players through the mail. Don't send somebody 15 items and expect them to sign them. You know, at the most, at this point, you know, in the, what I'd call the old days, you know, 20 years ago or something like that, I might stick 3 or 4 cards in an envelope and just mention to somebody, you know, that they're free to keep a couple if they'd like them. And sometimes I get all 4 signed back and sometimes I get 2 back. But rarely now in you know, we're in the age of eBay and internet selling and everything like that. And, of course, everybody's, particularly players, have gotten really jaded about this. I think if you send a handwritten request to somebody who is, you know, has a reputation or is known for being a willing signer, you know, don't stick more than 1 or 2 items in there. And then if you get it back, don't mail them another one the next week. You know, it's kind of like that. Because you're really tempted to do that when you're starting off. The other thing I say is be realistic about what your expectations are. You know, the fact that as great a player as Dan Fouts is, the fact that he will still sign items for people for free through the mail, I mean, that to me, that says a lot about him, and that's highly unusual. You got to be realistic about who you can expect to get back at things like that. And just do your homework.
Fouts went to U of O, so obviously he's a very gracious man.
Well, that's true. That's him and Steve Fontaine, right?
So. Exactly. Thank you. I have one more quick question, if you don't mind.
Sure. No.
Personalized requests. Like, I met Steve Largent when I was like a 10-year-old kid, and, you know, probably around 2002 or 2003, I sent him a picture of me as a, you know, a kid wearing a shirt, a Largent shirt, and him with an afro and a corduroy jacket on. And I sent it, and I for probably a week, I vacillated back and forth. Do I ask him to personalize this or just let it rip? What's your input on that? I mean, asking someone to personalize something. You talked about being gracious earlier.
Yeah. You know, I've got a little experience with that. You know, I've got, it's more in the baseball world than the football world. I had several photos of myself when I was young. We were either at the Cardinals game with School Boy Patrol or, you know, some sort of organization, things like that. So, you know, I've never, when I set something off that I wanted somebody to personalize, I've never thought 2 seconds about whether to ask them to do it or not. You know, I think that's fine. There are a couple instances that, you know, I've got a real good friend of mine is a Cleveland Browns fan. A couple of different times over the past several years, you know, I've picked up a pretty neat photo or something like that that I knew he'd like and knew the player signed it, and I sent it to the player and asked him to inscribe it to him and put happy birthday on it. And then I gave it to him for a birthday present. So yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all.
Jeff, we're running out of time. Do you have any other final thoughts you'd like to share with our audience? This has been a phenomenal education as far as autographs are concerned.
Well, you know, I think I told you in my note to you that I hoped I could be mildly informative. Yeah, I hope I was. I can tell you, I've done this for decades now, and it is just a lot of fun. It brings a lot of joy. It's something you can share with your kids. I've got a son that, you know, as a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go to spring training next week in Florida for a week, and, you know, I won't be doing a whole lot of autographing down there because I kind of like to sit back and let the kids do that down there. But it's just a whole lot of fun, you know. And like I say, if you're realistic about what your expectations are, and if you know, don't lose your mind, you know, be courteous, be thankful, realize that people are doing you a favor, and that they're not obliged to sign for you. I mean, that's one of the things that really kind of drove me crazy about the in-person at the stadium autograph thing is how many people, you know, thought that just because XYZ made $6 million a year playing baseball, playing football, that he was absolutely obligated to sign everything they had in their hand because they were paying his salary or something like that. But it's just not like that. You're really asking people for a piece of their time. And it's important to remember that, I think.
Now, you're going to be at the National this summer?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So I'll make sure I bring extra copies of 48 at the table. Because I never know.
I can make it. I'll see if I can make some more friends between now and then.
I'll have somebody come up to me and say, how many issue 48s do you have? I'll pay any price. And then I'll have the tractor trailer truck back up for your 10,000 cash.
That's right.
Jeff, thank you.
You're very
Jeff,
welcome.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Thanks,
we'll see
Jeff.
You this summer.
Thanks for your time.
Okay. Bye-bye. Jeff Drum, our interviewee tonight, super collector from issue 48. What a great article and great
story.
What
a nice guy.
Unbelievable.
How do you run into these people like this, Captain? I mean, like, how did you initially meet Jeff, and how does the conversation go where you ask someone to be a super collector?
Well, I did find out through a couple of collecting networks. He was a pretty big collector, and I basically shot him an email about the magazine, and then we did an interview and basically stayed quasi in touch over the past couple of years with regards to, like I said, I saw him at the last National in Chicago, and we talked a lot. And you know, he's an encyclopedia of autograph knowledge, and the wire photos to me are so beautiful. They're so historical, in my opinion. I probably have about a dozen wire photos in my collection from the 50s, and I always found those to be fascinating. I always found them to be real history. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And unfortunately today, you know, with the most newspapers selling off their collections and the collections being sold in bulk to dealers, they're becoming more and more of a difficult find to find. And when you do find them, you know, I could see a wire photo going for $5, $10, $15. I'm not going to pay $50, $100 for a wire photo. I really don't. You know, it doesn't do anything for me, type of thing. But if it's reasonably priced, it's a nice addition to the collection, you know, one way or the other. So I find that to be interesting. You know, getting back to what you say, where I find these people, you know, being in the hobby as long as I have, and I realize I'm a dinosaur in the hobby in a lot of ways, but I always realized when I started collecting cards, there were a lot of other areas of collection for football stuff. There were programs, there were ticket stubs, there were media guides, there are programs, there are sports publications like the Street and Smith. You have Super Bowl programs, championship programs, you have pocket schedules, you have pennants. And there was a lot of different people out there who had, you know, real niches as far as what they were collecting.
Yeah.
And I always found that to be real fascinating. And back in the 80s, in the early 90s, when I was even more active than I am today, and I was working part-time at a card shop here locally, I would always be amazed to see the stuff that would come into the store that people were selling, not just with football, but with all the sports. And I always said to myself, gee, I'd like to collect a little of everything. But I've always been pulled to the cards, and I've always been pulled to publications. And again, as the evolution of the hobby continues, we're seeing more and more electronic stuff now, and I think a lot of the printed matters is going to go by the wayside, and that's going to be, you know, problematic in the future, in my opinion. You know, so
I agree with you.
Something like
slope.
This, a real autograph with a real photo, is priceless as far as I'm concerned. And to me, Jeff really is preserving the history of the game,
without a doubt.
Very much so, with those photos and those autographs, to say the least.
Yeah.
So I'm very
honored
he was in the magazine, and he was, you know, he is truly a super collector with regards to that. And,
you're just amazing. You're right about wanting to collect, you know, everything you see come across your desk, because, I mean, that's a slippery slope. I mean, I used to collect just this set and that set, and then you start seeing other sets, you're like, oh, that's amazing. And then you start, you know, getting into uncut sheets and wax packs and cellos and, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, that Yahoo, John Spano and Andy Becker turned me on to, you know, type one photos and programs and ticket stubs and you start delving into the history, and next thing you know, you're all over the place. And at some point you have to take a deep breath and decide to focus on something. So,
I've got a very short attention span. That's something I could never do, is just focus on just one area of my collection. I always collected a lot of different things because I like them. And, you know, I got a full run of football cards, which I guess I'm known for more than anything else. But, you know, I have a strong, you know, publication collection, obviously. I got a strong ticket stub collection, so on and so forth. But, again, I go back, you know, way back to the 70s. I used to collect, when I went to a game, I made sure I saved the program and I saved the ticket stuff from the from those games. And I never really did it in the view that, oh, okay, I'm going to retire from this, you know, 50 years from now. It was always, I felt like I kept the memento and part of the game, you know, game's memory for me type of thing. And I thought that was very important. So that's where my collecting's at. Now we're getting real close to, you know what, time for our goal line stance. Joe, I'm handing off to you. What did we learn on tonight's show?
You know, I loved hearing Jeff's story about, you know, the story behind the autographs. I mean, that's the hidden fuel. I mean, you know, it's kind of like in golf. You know, you can be having a bad day and suddenly hit a really good shot, and you're like, I love this thing. I have a brother-in-law. I mean, he's married to my wife's sister, and he's an ex-pro baseball player. He played a year and a half in the pros. And when we go visit him in Minnesota, I mean, two, three times a week, he'll get something, you know, through the mail, request for auto. He played a year and a half, and that was, you know, probably 20 years ago, and this guy still gets stuff for requests. And I just remember asking him a couple years ago, I'm like, how often do you get these things? A couple times. I'm like, well, what's your, you know, how do you decide who to send stuff back for? And he's like, you know, kind of like what Jeff said, he was, well, I kind of keep a mental track of somebody if they, you know, he's like, no matter what, has to have a self-addressed stamped envelope. You know, and it was interesting hearing Jeff talk about that, and I've been able to talk to an ex-professional athlete about what the other side is perceived as, you know. So yeah, that was pretty cool to hear him, you know, kind of verify that. You know, what about you, Captain?
Well, I think it goes along with Jeff does is the preservation of the hobby, and in a pure form, the player's autograph with the player's photograph and or wire photo, action photo. And to me, you cannot express the hobby any better than what he does. Because, again, I'm all for the preservation of the game, preservation of the history of the game. And he's a keeper of the game, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he's got a unique collection that, to me, is basically priceless. And, you know, again, it's the preservation of the game, and that's what it's all about, and spreading the knowledge of, you know, what that actually represents in our hobby at the same time. Down to 2 minutes, Joe. Quickly, any more thoughts, ideas, comments?
Yeah, two real quick things, if you don't mind me going hog reserve, Captain. First one, you know, Jeff mentioned he's a Cardinals fan, and suddenly I felt this, you know, kind of camaraderie with him because, you know, as a Seahawks fan, and he's a Cardinals fan, we both have one thing in common is that we hate the Pittsburgh Steelers because the Steelers beat both of us in Super Bowls, you know, 2005 and 2007. And I started thinking about that Larry Fitzgerald touchdown with like 2 minutes to go, you know, in the Super Bowl, you know, where Fitzgerald just caught this thing and ran 60 yards in on a slant for a touchdown. I'm like, got him. Beat the Steelers. Yeah. So sorry, John Spano, but I'm not a big Steelers fan. And the other thing is, you know, Jeff had mentioned, you know, here he is a super collector collecting autographs, and the top five things, if he had to whittle the collection down, he admitted not one of them was an autograph. And I found that fascinating and incredibly respectful. And I thought to myself, yeah, what are my top five things? And not one of them is a Steve Largent thing. And I'm kind of known, you know, for Steve Largent. But, you know, if there's a fire and I'm grabbing five things, you know, most of my Steve Largent collection is going up in flames. You know, I thought that was fascinating and very insightful.
That's true. Well, Joe, we're almost out of time. I'd like to remind everyone, check out MSB Sports Cards, their website, msbsportscards.com, for one of the largest collections. Available for sale, football cards and memorabilia on the web, and check out BSC Auctions for their upcoming auction, bscauctions.com. Joe, thanks for being with me tonight, and
as
I'd
always.
Like to thank all our audience for listening, and we'll see you in a few weeks. Thanks for listening.
Ba, 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 ba.